Welcome to the Perp Web Podcast, hosted by Joe Bosch.
What is it, Nate? I'm going to put you on the spot again. What are we here to preserve? When we go on cardiopulmonary bypass on the pump, what is for, now it's all important, I understand that. But what's the most important, the most sensitive, the biggest worry we have? The brain.
Not the face, the brain.
The brain. We're worried about the brain. Exactly. Now, if you're Homer, you can get away with a lot. But most of us are just slightly, I'm barely slightly larger than that. Okay. Yeah, exactly. I get you. So we do perfuse the body as a whole. Clearly, we have to be concerned about it. The limbs, the heart, the kidneys, the liver, the gut. The gut, probably the most sensitive, but you know, you can go without blood flow to a limb for quite a while before it's irreversible. You know, the heart can tolerate quite a bit too. The kidneys, they're pretty sensitive. The liver, you know, shock liver generally comes back. But really, you know, we're there to provide the whole body with good perfusion, but we're just really worried about the brain, because it's so sensitive. So if you look here at this photograph, and this is just a hybrid of photographs that I made, various photographs I put together, there are 100 billion stars in the Milky Way. There are 100 billion neurons in just one human brain. It's a lot of neurons.
A lot of connections.
And 100 trillion synapses. It's a lot when you think about it. So how do we measure adequacy of perfusion? Generally speaking, we assume a lot. We do sometimes some fancy calculations. We measure DO2, you know, we're good. We measure the SVO2, you know, our SVO2 is good. We assume from that we're delivering the right amount of oxygen. Of course, we don't really measure oxygen extraction rate. So, you know, we assume they're extracting the oxygen. The SVO2 is high because we're flowing a lot. Should we flow less? I really don't know the answer to that. Labs, we look at the acid-base balance. If they're not developing acidosis, then we're perfusing enough. But you can become acidotic through dilutional means. If you're using sodium chloride, you dilute out the bicarb, you become acidotic. That doesn't really mean you're not perfusing. You have DO2. If you're doing MUF on pump, or you're doing CVVH on pump with replacement, and you're using sodium chloride, we've done it before to knock the potassium down, right? So you have a real high K. You ultrafiltrate off a liter, you give a liter of saline.
Oh yeah, having a double.
Ultrafiltrate off a liter, give a liter of saline. Well, your bicarb plummets, you become really acidotic and you have to correct for that. Okay, so you're giving sodium bicarb, you're giving sodium chloride, and now your sodium ends up 150, 156, 160, and now you got a different problem. That's why bicarb-based solutions are just way better than our acetate-based solutions.
That's why we use it for our IK cases.
Yeah. It's why we should use it, right? But I think we should use it for the pump prime. I think we should look at bicarb-based solutions for all of our cases as a traditional prime, not sodium chloride, not plasma light, not lactated ringers. It works, they're all good. But I think bicarb-based solutions are just the better solution to use. Problem is, they're just too expensive and they come in 5-liter bags. Nobody wants to package them in 1-liter bags because of cost. Cerebral oximetry. The concepts are easy to understand. Making them work in a usable device, however, is not so easy. The big problem with cerebral oximetry devices is that they figure out the saturation from putting a sticker on the forehead that has to go through the skin, the subcutaneous tissue, the muscle, the bone, and then ultimately to the brain and venous versus arterial blood, because you're gonna have a mixture.
Right.
It's not gonna be arterial or venous, it's going to be both. So there's a lot of confounding factors. Each device uses a different approach for delivering light and analyzing the reflection of the light back to it. Each device uses a different approach to compensate for adsorption by the different tissues. That's adsorption of the light, right? We just got through talking, or it's actually absorption, yeah. Not adsorption. Now I'm stuck on adsorption. Absorption, it absorbs the light. The analysis algorithm for every device is different from every other device, and no two commercial oximeters measure the same thing. The specific algorithm also that's used in for most devices is a secret. And the companies keep changing their algorithms and technology. So a study done in 2005 may not be applicable in 2013 and thus 2020. I think we need to take that seriously into consideration. No device is capable of providing a pure the saturation brain O2 or SbO2 value for the brain, no matter what the promotional literature says. I'm gonna say that one more time. No device is capable of providing a pure SbO2, that's the saturation, the oxygen saturation of the brain, no matter what the promotional literature says. The signal from all devices is contaminated by extracerebral blood. Again, skin, bone, getting through the fluid level, the fluid layer, the cerebrospinal fluid, you have a lot to go through. The dura. Here is an example, and this is very important. If I take a living patient, I'm going to get a cerebral oxygen saturation somewhere within that gray bar, but the mean of them is gonna be where the black line is,
okay?
Now, Nate, if I kill you and measure your cerebral saturation, then you're going to get a value somewhere within that gray bar.
Which also includes the...
With the mean value being with the black. Now, if I kill you and remove your brain, so you have just an empty skull,
well,
it's gonna be somewhere in that range. You will get a reading, okay? So cerebral oximetry, there was a really good article that was done some time ago called Pumpkin or Patient. Because they put the cerebral oximeter on a pumpkin with a candle in it and were getting readings consistent with a living patient. And this study came out of Schwartz. It was written in 1996. So there is, as far as stroke is concerned, because cerebral oximetry is trying to fill a need.
Right.
And that's to help avoid stroke. I'm not gonna say I don't believe in cerebral oximetry. I think it is a good device, but I think it has limitations.
Okay.
I think we need to recognize that it has limitations. It's not perfect.
No.
But if you are getting a number, if you're using it, you make the decision to use it, and it's on the patient, and your numbers are reading, let's just say 60 and 60, and they pick the heart up to do the circ graft, and your cerebral oximeter reading on the left side goes to 25. That should raise an alarm.
Right.
You should be saying something's wrong. Okay?
So you're saying use it as a trending device versus an absolute device?
Absolutely. I don't think you can get an absolute number. No one can convince me it's an absolute number because it isn't an absolute number.
Right.
But if you're gonna use it, then use it.
Right.
If your pre-op value is 60 and you go on pump and it's now 38 or 40 and your hematocrit is 18, 20, and you can't flow anymore.
Make an adjustment.
We don't like to give blood transfusions. But guess what?
Yep.
I feel you are obligated to give that patient a transfusion. I feel you have a responsibility at that point to treat that.
Use the
if you're
going to
use
there,
it, yeah. Then use it.
Yep.
That's Absolutely. How I feel about that. Encephalopathy, well, let's look at this. Perioperative stroke rates in cardiac surgery range from 1.7 to 2.9%. That's higher. That's pretty high. That's high, you think about it. Think about it, 3 out of 100.
3 out of 100, so that's going.
Gonna have a stroke. That's a lot, and it's too high. Encephalopathy rates, however, are much higher, 7.7 to 13.8%. So you come out of the surgery, you wake up, you're confused, you're not doing well, you don't have classic, you have not had a classic stroke, but you are not yourself. So you have encephalopathy that's secondary to what? Was it an embolic stroke? Was it a hypoperfusion stroke, a hypoxic stroke? I mean, what was it? Do you have hypoxic brain injury? What happened during the surgery? Was it a flow issue, oxygenation issue, embolic issue, all of the above?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking.
I would think that it'd be flow related mostly because of the manipulations we're doing with the heart. Most of our surgeons, all of our surgeons come down on flow. And they, if I'm mistaken, all of them want you to come off at that point. Maybe one or two will just want you to come down to minimal flow, a liter or whatever.
For what?
To put the clamp, cross clamp on.
Oh yeah, or, but that's transient. Well, no, that's very transient.
But then you have other times when we are down for a while because they're trying to get to a graft that's bleeding or something.
Yeah, we've had that happen before.
So it'd be a minute or two where you're literally off pump. Then maybe your pressures drop and you're not getting good perfusion to the brain. You're getting it elsewhere, but you're not getting it good to the brain. Like you talked about hemodilution. You can have some issues there and some edematous issues, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
In the same manner.
Yeah.
In that way that could cause issues.
I think those are very good points. So these encephalopathic episodes are much harder to diagnose than a stroke. You can't move one side, you've had a stroke. Your mouth is dropping off of one side, you had a stroke. Those changes can be subtle, can be combative patients, whatever. But it results usually in, of course, a delay in extubation. So let me take just a minute here to beat on myself and my colleagues that may be watching this program. I'll ask you, Nate, do we as a routine have any idea what happens to our case unless we get called back?
Absolutely not.
No. Do we ever see the patient preoperatively?
Extremely rarely.
Extremely rare.
Basically no, but once in a blue moon.
Mm-hmm. Do we see the patient post-op at any time in the ICU, unless we're going there to put them on ECMO?
Transport, but we don't really see them long-term, no.
We drop them off, we leave. We go check on them the next day?
If I'm in that facility. But as a general rule, we work in, what, six cardiac
facilities? That's good that you do if you're in that facility, but you might be in a different facility.
Right, so no.
Right. The real answer is no.
Yeah.
Right. So. There. Shouldn't we be more aware?
Yes.
I think we should.
We should, but there are constraints within our profession that oftentimes won't allow it. For instance, what we're in, we have six facilities that we do hearts in.
That's true too. That's a good point.
It's tough.
So stroke is deadly. You have a threefold increase in mortality at 10 years if you've had a stroke after cardiac surgery. It's debilitating. Most people, especially the elderly, when they're going to have heart surgery, will tell you they fear stroke worse than death. It's very hard, if not impossible, to maintain your independence and enjoy normal, everyday, important activities. Your quality of life is more important than your longevity. And of course, you'll have decreased cognition and mental acuity. And those are really, I mean, think about how fearful that would be. It's also incredibly financially devastating for the patient, for the hospital, because they're like, the stay is going to be much longer, of course, and for society, because now this person is going to require services that they ordinarily would not have needed, certainly much sooner than they would have needed them, of course. So there was this big deal about bashing the pump. Going back to 1990, it was the pump head syndrome, right? And it was in the Wall Street Journal. And they blamed the pump for cognitive dysfunction associated with open heart surgery on the heart-lung machine. Dr. Stump, of course, came out with the SCADs and how the pump caused that problem. And that was more relevant to bubble oxygenators. I actually think he was probably right, but there's other things. Blood air interface and the suctions causes you to have these protein bubbles, that coated bubbles that will never dissipate and they become embolic in nature. And of course, off pump, that was the launch of off pump. That's what created the whole off pump craze. And in this article, off pump versus on pump coronary artery bypass grafting, big study, 4,700 patients. You can see here the first primary outcomes of 30 days. And what do you see? You see off pump and on pump stroke exactly the same. You see death exactly the same. You see non-fatal MI a little higher in the on pump group, and you see new renal failure basically the same. So the big problem was that your revascularization
wasn't as good.
Your need for another intervention was much higher. So there was no real benefit. Now, at 30 days, basically, you could see there was really no difference. But off pump was associated with less transfusions and reoperation for bleeding. There was slightly less acute kidney injury. There was less respiratory infections and failure, and more early, again, need for revascularizations. That's the downside. That's not a benefit. Okay, it was associated with more early need for revascularization. So that's that information. So it isn't the pump. Now, I want you to soak this in if you're watching at home, and I want you to just think about it for a minute, okay? Just think about it. Okay, that's probably long enough. If you're not traumatized before, you're traumatized now. TAVR and stroke has been an awakening. A stroke occurs during a TAVR.
Oh, I did not know that.
100% of the time. And I will contend to you that stroke occurs in cardiac surgery 100% of the time.
Do you mean on bypass or in general?
Heart surgery, open heart surgery.
That's what I was asking.
On pump, off pump, I don't care. Stroke occurs 100% of the time with TAVR. It occurs 100% of the time with open heart surgery. The majority of these strokes are embolic. All strokes are consequential. And cerebral embolic protection device investigations and industry has been launched because of this very real problem. Now, where it gets a little bit confusing is how do you define a stroke? Because I said a stroke occurs 100% of the time. Who's going to want to have heart surgery?
Right.
Who's going to want to have a TAVR? It's all in the definition. Stroke has always been what we consider to be the obvious signs. You're stroked.
Right.
They're laying in the bed. You have a hemiparesis. It's obvious they have had a stroke. However, that's a class one stroke. A number of years ago, they came out with classes of strokes. Class one, the overt. Class two is any new lesion under diffusion-weighted MRI of the brain. And that's what you see there. The hyperluminosities are basically embolic strokes. Now, they may not be clinically relevant or clinically obvious. You may not see it today.
Right.
But if there's a billion neurons in that brain, how many hundreds of thousands do you think are now gone with those embolic events? A bunch. The brain's pretty remarkable, but those areas of the brain are dead neurons, dead synapses. They're not gonna work, has to get rerouted. And if it just hits the right spot, you start having that memory fade.
Right.
You start changing your personality a little bit, remembering things quite the same way. Every single embolic event to the brain is consequential.
Makes sense.
We need to start understanding that and accepting that as a reality and doing something to fix it. We don't do anything to fix it. So these new industries have been launched. Take a look at this. This is a cerebral embolic protection device. No, that's not. This is a TAVR. I lied. This is a TAVR. You see it going in. You see how it's staying central lumen? They just dilated the balloon. It all looks great, right?
Except for the embolic shower from the...
Well, let's watch. Let's watch. Look, here comes the valve. It's going to come up. They're going to change it over. Look at how perfect that is. Look at that beautiful aorta. Look at how it's right smack in the middle. Goes around so perfectly. Goes into place. New valve is deployed. It's going to happen. There it goes. Do the rapid pacing and deploy it. Look at how beautiful that looks. Okay. So what's the reality? Well, the reality is, as that thing is going up the aorta and starting to make that turn around the arch, it's banging against that superior wall of the aorta. And it's breaking off pieces of atheroma, calcification, tissue, whatever else is getting knocked off as it comes around. You can see it on the lateral aspect of the aorta down by the sinotubular junction. You can see it, I'm sure, right there in A. Then it goes in, and as you're passing it through and dilating the valve to implant it, you see you have another massive shower. And then as you take it out and it just sits there for a little while, it's still gonna be some residual showering take place. What effect did that have? Now, you have this device. This is the Sentinel device. It's put in through the axillary artery, and it one stays in the innominate, and the other one goes up into the left carotid. And what that does is actually captures any embolic material that goes up. Now, the limitation of it is there's nothing in the left subclavian, and of course, the vertebral comes off the left subclavian, so you still have some risk. You also have risk putting it in, because if you put it in, you will also have a shower of some embolic material. But will it be the same load as it would be putting that big TAVR in? Look, again, barring a large trial, and I know the trials are being done with this and they're looking at stroke mitigation and does it really work and all of that kind of stuff. I'm a common sense kind of guy. It just makes sense.
To use that.
It just makes sense. It just makes sense. Period.
So
you know, there's statistics. What, how does that saying go? What did Mark Twain say?
Lies.
Statistics, lies, damn lies, and statistics. Yeah, exactly.
So real quick before you go to the next slide, let me ask you this, and you may cover this later. What are your feelings as to similar devices that don't deploy in there, but they deploy in the aorta that are made for pump runs?
Absolutely. I think that, yes, I'm not going to cover it. It was going to be part of the discussion, and I think we should discuss it. But I think it's a very good point. So write that down so that I don't forget to discuss it, because I think that is a very good point. And I'm not sure that it wouldn't make sense to just use this device. So back to the pump. Not all strokes are caused by the pump. We know that. But the pump is not free of stroke risk from hypoperfusion, from embolic gas or particulate, from hypocarbia, gross hypocarbia, because, you know, CO2 really controls cerebral perfusion. Right. You can get your CO2 low enough and restrict cerebral blood flow by 50% if you get your PCO2 down, let's say, to 20.
Yeah.
And I've had it happen to me before. I've had it happen. And so, you know, and it's concerning.
You had a confirmed stroke, or you had a...
I just had a CO2 that low and fixed it right away, but it made me a little nervous. Disconcerting, certainly. We know that clamping and unclamping the aorta are embolic.
Right.
We know that.
Absolutely.
You remember the days of the Embolex catheter?
Yeah.
They would find debris in that thing every single time they sent it in. And frequently we saw huge chunks in it, okay? Is the heart position effectively affecting the flow or generating emboli. So I think what I'm trying to say there is when they pull the heart over and change the cannula position and it's jetting against the aortic wall, what is that cause and what's happening there?
If your cannulation site is right next to a plaque that you didn't know was there, because not everybody checks the aorta with the ultrasound.
With the ultrasound, right. Do we know if the pump sucker is causing emboli, as in the case of Dr. Stump? Do we know if the flow is adequate for cerebral perfusion? Oh, I know what I was asking in that first one. Is the heart position affecting flow? In other words, are we flowing well enough to the brain?
Right.
I think that's where I was going with that. Excuse me. Do we know if the flow is adequate for cerebral perfusion? Do we know if VAD or kinetic assist has an effect on embolic events? Does a dry venous line have an effect? If you go on with the dry venous line, reduce hemodilution. I used to do it. I did it for years. But does it generate more guests among emboli? I can't imagine it does, but I really don't know. But I don't think it does. Is a closed system better than an open system? There's still a lot of people that use bags. I don't know the answer to that either. When we go down on the flow, does it matter if we clamp the line or does it matter if we turn the flow down?
I'd like to get your opinion on that one in particular.
Me too.
What's your opinion, though?
Does pulsing have an effect on flow or generating emboli? That's another question. And are our temperature gradients during cooling and warming really safe?
That's a big one. I don't know about stroke-wise, but I've had that thought before, because a lot of times our surgeons will drift and then they say rewarm. Well, it's a big patient. I mean, it's a 115-kilo patient, and I know that he's got two proximals. Well, to rewarm, I got to scramble. I got to be cranked wide open, and we're starting at 30 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And these rooms are cold, in some cases really cold. And so it takes quite a bit to rewarm that patient. So I've got my water temp cranked. There's no other way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, at the end, they're sitting on there waiting on me, and mm-hmm. they're looking at me going, did you start rewarm when I rewarm? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I told you 10 minutes, or asked you 10 minutes before mm-hmm. that for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways,
yeah.
Sorry.
We probably shouldn't do that. But the brain is very sensitive to hypoxia. It auto-regulates. You've got the cerebral perfusion pressure and you have CO2 to control it. It weighs about 1,300 to 1,400 grams, takes 15% of the cardiac output, which is about 50 to 55 mLs per 100 grams of brain matter. Has this very conveniently positioned vascular system. So compared to the heart at 4 to 5% of cardiac output, having your, in terms of the brain, the cerebral perfusion pressure, however, outside of 60 to 160 millimeters mercury pressure, autoregulation is lost. If you breathe 5% CO2, and we used to use 95.5 on our pumps back in the old days, but if you breathe 5% CO2, so 95% oxygen, 5% CO2, you will increase your CO2 and your cerebral blood flow by 100%.
Really?
And basically engorge your brain. It's bad for you. You should not do it.
No, I'm just saying.
Breathing CO2 is bad.
It's a giant difference is what I was getting at. Not
that's
that
right.
Should do it or shouldn't. But.
A PCO2, on the other hand, of 28 will result in a decrease in cerebral blood flow between 12 and 24 milliliters per 100 grams. Now it's 50 to 55 millimeters per 100 grams normally. So you could reduce it just with a PCO2 of 28 by 50%. That's significant.
Significant.
Because I was like freaking out when my PCO2 was 20.
Right.
I can't imagine what I was doing. But how many times do we just accept the PCO2 of 28? I've seen it many times. I have.
I mean, I don't like it,
but I deal with it.
Right, we do it.
I don't get that worried about it. Maybe I should.
Maybe you should.
Here's basically cerebral anatomy, cerebral blood flow anatomy. We're all familiar with it. I won't go over it too much. Transcranial Doppler. Transcranial Doppler takes advantage of the middle cerebral artery, which is what you're seeing there, and it looks at it, the one coming to it, and the one going away from it on the contralateral side. And you can tell on the CCD device, if it's red, it's coming to you. If it's blue, it's going away from you, right? You could have two channels. Bob Groom, and I've talked about this before, had been talking about cerebral oximetry for a very long time. This was written up in 2009, so 11 years ago. And even before that, he was talking about it. But he was showing how TCD, and they would change things on the pump. He would give medication. They would see a bump up in the TCD, in the embolic events. He would do tap the line. And there would be, now that wasn't artifact, because you can tell artifact from that. You would see a shower of embolic material, probably air that was hung up in connectors. There was something somewhere.
Right.
Okay. So he's been advocating the use of TCD for many, many years. How can perfusionists be a part of this solution? Well, I think TCD just makes a lot of sense. I'm going to show you there are some newer technologies, because the old style TCD, you have to put this thing on the head and you have to sort of aim it, and it's challenging and it takes some skill and it's labor intensive. There are some issues associated with it, and you're dealing with real estate. I'm going to show you an image of why I think there may be a limitation to this, but there are some newer technologies that are easier to use. They do have billing codes, so it does help as far as payments are concerned. Can help determine if there was a problem. It can't prevent a problem on that case. And I know I hear this argument all the time. Well, it's already happened. What's the point? I'll tell you the point. It goes to what you just got through saying. Exactly. We're going to talk about that. It's highly specific to both flow and embolic events. So it will show you whether or not you have good flow through the middle cerebral artery. You can see it. If your cerebral perfusion pressure, if you don't have a good opening pressure and it's clamped down, it's not opening.
Not getting flow.
You don't have flow. You know it. Okay? Can help change your practice. Can be easily learned by perfusion, can become a tool for perfusion to improve our outcomes, reduce our stroke. And I think we should just get more involved and know what has happened to your patients. I think that's important to know. Here's that new technology I talked about. It's the Lucid Robotic Transcranial Doppler. Now, I reached out to this company and asked them via email if they would be willing to participate in the program and talk about this thing, but they have never responded. So I've gotten no response from them. However, in the future, you know, if you're watching this, Lucid, and you want to be involved in this, would love to hear from you. But this is a robotic and automated device, which is a lot easier than the old style TCDs. However, and with that said, you notice you're occupying a lot of real estate. That's going to be in the way of anesthesia.
Absolutely.
For this to be adopted into routine cardiac surgery, it's going to require that being a whole lot smaller,
right,
and a whole lot easier to use.
Right away.
I think that's the issue that I have with it. But I think it's brilliant, and I think it needs to be done. So as Don Remsold said, there are known knowns. And there are things that is, these are things we know that we know. There are unknown, or known unknowns, rather. That is to say, there are things that we know we don't know, but there are also unknown unknowns. These are the things we don't even know we don't know. And that's, I think, the thing about cerebral blood flow when we're on pump. There's just so much we don't even know that we don't know. But it's something I think we need to really start paying attention to. So here's a good friend of mine, Dr. Zolt Gourami. He's kind of the guy that got me involved, you know, sort of excited about TCD. Brilliant guy, works with NASA, is really an expert. He's given a lecture here on TCD before at a couple of the conferences that I've had. Would love to have him more involved in this and back, because I think TCD is a tool for perfusion that we should be using more of. And I think that perfusionists around the globe should become more involved in understanding stroke, stroke mitigation, and how we contribute to strokes as perfusionists. So you can open the phone lines. We'll have our discussion. Let's have the first thing, what you had mentioned to me. So let's talk about changing your practice.
Okay. Rephrase that question. Let me start there. When you say changing your practice.
So let me ask you this. When the surgeon says to you, come down on your flow, he's going to put the clamp on.
Right.
Come down on your flow. What do?
Generally, I partially clamp the line. Okay. There are times when my hands are busy, I'm doing other things, because it always happens when I'm doing other things, whether it's coming on, clamp off. Mm-hmm. So there are times when I clamp the whole line. Mm-hmm. But generally, I try, and I've actually changed now lately to trying to bring the pump flows down as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you a question. When you're shooting water through a line, mm-hmm. and you take a clamp and you're flowing 5 liters a minute of just saline, pumping it out into the air, and you take a clamp Absolutely. And you clamp across it.
You're not having nice linear flow. I know what you're saying.
What happens to that pressure at the end of the line?
Say that it went
the pressure
outflow,
at the end of the line, the outflow. Reduced, but it, how does it behave?
You're not having a nice streamlined linear flow, if that's what you're asking.
Well, when you clamp it, just acutely, to clamp
it. Stops. That's what you're
saying. It just stops.
Absolutely.
And it, woof, you feel that pressure drop. And if you're going through a cannula in the aorta, flowing 5 liters a minute, and I just reach over and clamp the arterial line, and that thing pressure drops, and it has that little reverberation we see. Mm-hmm. How much emboli are being caused there? And then you reach over and you pop the clamp off, mm-hmm. and you whoof, right back up to 5 liters. If every time you did that, and you were using cerebral oximetry, and you saw major embolic events occur, but when you turn the flow down by reducing the RPMs of the pump, the rheostat control, and then coming back up, you didn't see that, would you change your practice?
Yeah.
You would, because you'd have proof.
Yeah,
now, proof. Does it happen? I don't know. I would love to test the hypothesis. I would love to test it.
I would lean toward yes, but again, we don't have proof of that.
We don't. We don't have proof. But absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Correct.
So we're now confronted with that. I think it matters, but I've also been in the same situation you are. Flow down, clamp. They want the flow down.
Right.
I understand that. Maybe we need to be, maybe they need to be more aware. What if you think the surgeons knew that every time you did that, something bad happened? Would they be more likely or less likely to be more patient?
Absolutely more likely. Without question, they would be more likely to be patient. Now, having said that, some of our surgeons are, they don't want to know because they just want to keep going because they're that fast and they want to maintain that speed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they have good outcomes.
And they have good outcomes.
Have good outcomes.
The way I said it before wasn't fair. Saying the way you said it, they have good outcomes, and that's a more fair way to say it.
That's okay. I'm here to help you. You can help me too. Yeah, they all have great outcomes.
Fantastic.
We all do. Exactly. But I think it's something we should be more aware of. I would love to know. I would love to put a model, on bypass, somehow be able to measure, because it'd be better if it was blood. So it'd be better if we were using an animal model and be monitoring TCD and clamp the line, release the line, clamp the line, release the line at 5 liters a minute and see what happened versus turning the flow up and down. It may be just as bad. I really don't know.
I wouldn't think it. I mean, yes, it may be. But I wouldn't think it would be because we are literally talking, like you said, you're completely
five to zero.
Five to zero. And then on the other side, even though they say come up slow, it doesn't, they say come up slow, you're taking that clamp off. So even if you bring your RPMs down, you're still getting a sudden resurge there of flow.
Absolutely. Okay. Any questions? Anything from Facebook?
No.
Any questions?
No, I did want to
learn something today. You got a question to ask?
We were talking about the embolic devices for CPV.
Yes. Oh, yes. So wouldn't it be something if we put that in? They had the Embolex catheter. That's come off the market.
What was the reason for it to come off the market?
The reason, the stated reason was because it was coated with heparin and that it didn't have the proper FDA approval because it was technically then a drug and or a drug eluting.
Right.
And it had to go through a different set of scrutiny by the FDA. And Edward said, we're not spending the money on it. And they just took it off
because
the market.
It's implanted. Technically, it's
just because it had heparin on it. If it didn't have heparin on it, then it wouldn't have been an issue. Then its approval was not based on it having a heparin coating.
Hmm. Oh, I see. Okay.
That's what I heard. No, I don't know if that's true, but that's.
I didn't know if it was that or if it was because it created its own series of issues.
No, so they took it off the market. Okay. But studies didn't really show a stroke reduction benefit with it. Interestingly enough, even though I don't know how that's possible.
That's what I was thinking, because you see a lot of
images. I have pictures of it with big chunks. You would have been toast.
Right.
You would have been toast. So I don't understand that. You know, I can't quite figure it out, but it is what it is. I think that there's two different ones. I showed you the Sentinel, the clarinet one, or the Sentinel claret. And then there's another one that's, I can't remember the name of it, but it basically covers all three of the arch vessels. But that is an embolic collection device. This one is a deflector. And it's essentially a net that goes around the aorta where the arch vessels are, all three. And then anything that hits it will go downstream to where it wouldn't do as much harm.
Right, right.
So that's how that works. Okay. So there's two out there. I to some degree think they should be used routinely in cardiac surgery. But again, you know, we are an evidence-based, you know, study addicted society that feels that we have to have data that is conclusive in order to be able to, right, to say that we should do this. You know, I'm not a physician, and I understand that there are perhaps differences in because of that, but I'm kind of a commonsensical guy. I see the risk benefit heavily outweighing using it in a positive way as opposed to not using it.
Right.
Given how high our stroke rate really is. I mean, for an isolated aortic valve, it's 5 to 7%.
When you talk to these surgeons, and I know you speak to them a lot more than we do as far as this kind of stuff.
Not really.
Well,
just because I'm interested in it.
Right. So do you talk to them about this kind of thing? You know, would you use this type of device if it was available? And if so, what do they tell you? Like, the reason why I asked specifically one surgeon, I won't say his name, but I asked one surgeon in this area, this device, you know, I've seen this before, I saw it at one of the meetings, and he honestly said, my outcomes are good, why would I change anything? Mm-hmm. Why would I change anything?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He said, it won't do any good. That's mm-hmm. what his answers were. And mm-hmm. I can speak for the guy to say that he's a very data-driven person.
Yeah.
So I think he probably has good enough outcomes that he feels that he doesn't need it. It's mm-hmm. an honest feeling, yeah. But.
And what is good enough? I mean, then that becomes a separate issue. What is good enough? Is a stroke rate of 2.9%, is that good enough? If you're one of the 2.9%.
Not if you're one of the 3 out of 100.
You know?
100% correct.
So yes, we are a data-driven society. We have to have study after study after study that is conclusive, and then it has to be labeled as a 1A recommendation by the STS before it ever gets done.
Right.
And that takes years and years and years and years and years. I'm more of a, this makes a lot of sense.
Right, we not in the same vein, but we had a similar discussion with a surgeon locally. I told him, we had all went over the AMSAC guidelines and,
yes.
and reading the guidelines and see what's going on. How can we change our practice? Cause we kind of have a slowdown mm-hmm. right now.
Mm-hmm.
So one of them was the sucker, you know, turn mm-hmm. the sucker off as soon as we start protamine. So I said, leave the sucker on. I said, you know, this is a shall, this is something we should do. And his honest to goodness answer was, I didn't say I'd do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right, well, we leave it on. Mm-hmm. So that's, I'm just saying, that's how they, a lot of times, that's how they feel. Why am I changing anything? I haven't had that issue before.
Yeah.
I've never clawed it off.
There's no benefit to leaving the pump sucker on. There's none. There's none. And I just fundamentally.
No, I'm just using that as an example to say they're not going to change.
No, let's talk about that now.
Go ahead,
so you went down the rabbit hole, so let's just go down the rabbit hole. It makes no sense to me whatsoever.
To leave
none. Even if you lost a couple of hundred cc's, you're never going to get it back from the pump, and you're running the risk of clotting your pump off. Just use the Cell Saver. I have a much better chance of giving those red cells back to the patient than I do if you put it over here. I turn the pump suckers off as soon as the protamine is in somebody's hand. As soon as I hear the word, I hear the P, and they don't get to the EEN part, and I've already got it off. I'm not doing this. I've had the pump clot off on me twice.
Yeah.
And you only have to have it happen once, but to have it happen twice in a career, I've been doing this a long time, you don't want that experience. And it's, you know, one was because protamine was given without telling anyone it was being given.
That's a bad day.
Yeah, that was a bad day. And we had to go back on pump.
Oh, that's a really bad day.
So that was that disaster. The other one had to do with what you're talking about. Leave the suckers on, leave the suckers on, leave the suckers on. I'm like, you know, till they had 50% of the protamine in, and then we had to go back on pump, and the pump was clotted off.
Yeah.
So, I, you know, you don't have to have it happen to you very often. So I've actually physically had it happen as my professional practice, my professional career, where the pump has clotted off because they left the suckers running while the protein was being administered. No more. I won't do it.
Yeah. What I tend to do in those instances, and I wasn't trying to go down this rabbit hole. I was just using an example. But what I tend to do in those instances are if I feel that we're getting close to that kind of situation, I just add some heparin. So I'm ready. You know, and generally, our Cell Savers are really good at removing that.
You probably add the heparin like that, but that's good.
Well, take the care. It just depends on how you do it. Actually, I've gotten back into using a syringe, so
you're good. Yeah. All right, good. So with that said, if there's no other questions or comments, we're going to end a little early. All right. That's